You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. So glad to have you with us. Tom Hartman here with you. The president is in Tallinn, Estonia. I was in Tallinn. Louise and I were in Tallinn. It was just either months or within the year, the first year after the fall of the Soviet Union. Estonia, we were in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. We took the train up through those areas. And from Germany up through Warsaw and then up to Riga and Vilnius and then Tallinn. And then up to Denmark is our it's a whole long story. Anyway, the stores were not open. I mean, there were stores open. There was commerce going on, but there were no businesses. There were no signs during the communist era. You could not have commercial signs, no businesses. So you had to ask around to find out where there might be a kind of hole-in-the-wall restaurant. There were a couple of hotels that were working, a few B&Bs. But most of the commerce that was done by street vendors who were out in the streets just, you know, literally selling things. And in many cases, what they were selling were their worldly possessions. You had street vendors who were selling off their homes. We were sitting in Poland in a coffee shop and in Warsaw, and an old woman came up to us with a box with her husband's war medals, trying to sell them. And just tore my heart out. I mean, we also were seeing, as we went from country to country to country, and these were countries that had never had homeless people, because communism, as much as you may not like its you can make your own choices dimension, did guarantee everybody housing, a job, and education, and health care, period. And when that, not just a social safety net, when that social blanket got ripped off and these countries got thrown into the, not just a traditional European Brave New World, I mean, they didn't even have the protections that Germans or French had. You know, the guys who were advising the Soviet Union as they unraveled the Soviet Union were from the Chicago School of Economics. They were basically libertarians. And they were saying, you don't need strong unions, like Germany actually wrote into their constitution after World War II, that you had to have a strong union. They said, you don't need that. And, you don't need national health care. And you don't need all that. That's all communism. Get rid of all that stuff. Privatize everything that the state owns. Give everybody coupons for their apartments and things. Let them sell them on the free market if they want, or let them accumulate others. And people did. They sold them to get food. And the people who ultimately became the oligarchs were the smart business guys who bought them all up, saw what was coming, figured out how to game the system. And now you've got billionaires in, you know, all of these countries, or very, very wealthy people, and a lot of poor people. The next step was for them to join NATO. And this is something that, you know, when the Soviet Union was unraveled, the explicit commitment was made to Russia that we would not take, particularly Estonia and Ukraine, which are countries that have a border with Russia, that we would not bring NATO into these countries. And, you know, in the late 90s, the Clinton administration broke that deal. And, you know, I don't know enough about the history of how that deal got broken or what rationale went into it that I'm going to sit here and blame Bill Clinton for it. But it happened. And, you know, whether this was European driven or American driven, I don't know. There's actually an expert on this stuff, John Mearsheimer, who wrote a great piece that's over at Foreign Affairs Magazine. It came out yesterday, called Why the Ukraine Crisis is the West's Fault, the Liberal Delusions that Provoked Putin. And I'm not sure what he means by liberal. I think he's just talking about, you know, Western European and American. But he says, you know, the prevailing wisdom in the West, Ukraine crisis can be blamed almost entirely on Russian aggression. Vladimir Putin annexed Crimea, trying to resuscitate the old Soviet Empire, etc. And the ouster of Viktor Yanukovych in February of 2014 was just a pretext for Putin's decision to seize part of Ukraine. bat narrative, he says, is completely wrong. You know, what this all has to do with is NATO expansion. And the fact that, I mean, this is as if Vladimir Putin was, President Putin was trying to expand Russian influence at the board, at the Canadian border, cutting a deal with Ottawa or something, or Montreal, and or Mexico. How would we respond? Well, how did we respond in 1962 when he cut a deal with Cuba? I think we know how we would respond. We would say, get the hell off our border. And, you know, unless you're a solid ally, and we sort of had that, you know, until the late 90s, and then this NATO creep into these former Soviet states, these former Soviet countries. Now, in order to mollify Russia, we didn't put NATO forces in those countries. So Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland are now part of NATO, but they don't have Soviet forces, or they don't have NATO forces there. And the whole thing around Ukraine is whether or not Ukraine is going to become part of NATO. And, you know, President Yanukovych said, no, we're not going to be part of NATO. And so, you know, we, they, whoever, fill in the blank, got rid of him. And, you know, now you've got this new guy who is gung-ho NATO. And then Obama, President Obama, this is what baffles me. And I just have to say, it baffles me. Is it, you know, who is he listening to? Henry Kissinger actually wrote a really good piece. I believe it was for the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago about the New World Order. And you know, saying, wait a minute, you know, we need to define these things in terms of what our ultimate goals are, rather, you know, and is our, do we really have a goal of just, you know, having NATO expand as much as possible right up to the edges of Russia? And why should we be surprised when they react this way? These are not the things that Kissinger, the points that Kissinger made. He brought up this larger issue of the New World Order. But this is what Mearsheimer writes. He says, this account is wrong. The United States and its European allies share most of the responsibility for the crisis. The taproot of the trouble is NATO enlargement, the central element of a larger strategy to move Ukraine out of Russia's orbit and integrate it into the West. And he says, since the mid-1990s, Russian leaders have adamantly opposed NATO enlargement. In recent years, they've made it clear that they would not stand by while their strategically important neighbor, that would be Ukraine, turned into a Western bastion. So here's what President Obama had to say in Estonia, with a border on Russia. Here's what he had to say.
During the long Soviet occupation, the great Estonian poet, Maria Under, wrote a poem in which she cried to the world, who'll come to help? Right here, at present, now. And I say to the people of Estonia and the people of the Baltics, today we are bound by our treaty alliance. We have a solemn duty to each other. Article 5 is crystal clear. An attack on one is an attack on all. So if in such a moment you ever ask again who'll come to help, you'll know the answer. The NATO alliance, including the armed forces of the United States of America, right here, present now.
Let me quote Otto von Bismarck, right, the leader of Germany in 1888. The great European war will come out of some damn foolish thing in the Balkans. He also said all treaties with great states cease to be binding when they come into conflict with the struggle for existence. I mean, this is let's start World War One kind of talk, or kind of stuff. It's not the talk specifically of the president, but just the fact that this is our policy concerns me and concerns many, many thoughtful people around the world. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
On a, you know, less dreadfully serious note, we have a third case of air rage, plane diverted yesterday. What's up with that? I want to get into that one. And welcome back. Hang on just a second here. 1-2. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John, watching Free Speech TV in Westfield, Vermont. You wanted to talk about guns?
1-2.
John, we got a put your, you can't listen to your TV. It's, there's a delay there. You got to listen to your phone. Bob in Lafayette, Georgia. Hey, Bob, global warming?
Yeah, I just wanted your opinion or your output on global warming. Is it possible that the pollution in the air gets up so far and it just keeps building up that it leaves like a magnifying glass effect where the sun would beam down through it and warm up the earth in certain spots or something like that?
Well, you're close to it. The way that carbon dioxide works is it allows sunlight, and all the energy associated with sunlight to pass through it. It strikes the earth. A lot of that energy, those photons of light, these particle pieces, energy, whatever you call it, of light, get converted into heat. And then carbon dioxide acts like a quilt. It holds that heat in. So it allows the sunlight in, basically allowing the heat in, and then it doesn't let it out. So the higher the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere, the more you're going to have this blanket around the planet effect of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And that's that. That's the principal carbon pollution. It's not the particulate stuff, you know, the stuff that makes it so you can't see through the air that does this. In fact, if anything, the particulate stuff reflects sunlight. And so less sunlight hits the ground and converts to heat. If it's dark particulate stuff, then that may absorb sunlight. And you've got a lot of soot on snow in the north, for example, that's making it absorb heat more than it should. But this is the three principal greenhouse gases, Bob, are carbon dioxide. This is the biggest one. Methane is the second biggest. And now we're starting to see this coming out of our oceans in big ways. Methane is about 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide. Over a 20-year period, over, you know, a 40, 50-year period, it's about 80 times, and it degrades fairly quickly. I think it's about 20 years is its half-life in the atmosphere. And then the third one are the human-made, there's a whole variety of them, human-made gases, including the chlorofluorocarbons, the CCFs, or CFCs, I guess they are, that were used to for air conditioning and things like this. They are very, very potent greenhouse gases. They do degrade in the atmosphere. Most of them degrade in the atmosphere over time. But we're dialing back on a lot of those, at least in the first world. But the third world is starting to produce them. Have I answered your question, Bob?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Great. I do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the call. And this is the concern. I mean, you know, a coal-fired power plant is pumping out hundreds of millions of tons of carbon dioxide. And the fact is we have burned 300 billion tons of carbon fuels since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, about 350 billion tons. And it's in the atmosphere now. It's, you know, we've seen the CO2 levels go up, and that's what's causing global warming by acting as like a blanket around the planet. And we're continuing to dump carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We need to stop. If you want to learn more about this, go to GreenWorldRising.org. We'll be right back. Leg room. This is... Let me get back to... I'm just going to wrap up the president. The president also talked this morning about ISIS in the Middle East in his comments in Tallinn. We have that clip too, right, Shano? Here it is.
Our objective is clear, and that is to degrade and destroy ISIL so that it's no longer a threat, not just to Iraq, but also the region and to the United States.
So I'm curious, you know, why is he calling this ISIL and we all call it ISIS? ISIL is, you know, Iraq and the Levant, which means the area that goes beyond Syria. Is that an insult to them, or is that greater respect to them, or is, you know, what's accurate? I honestly don't know. And there was a third clip, wasn't there? Yeah, okay. And this is again back to the, I don't think that the president understands the whole backstory in Ukraine and the whole NATO backstory. And I think if he did, he would be more thoughtful about dancing us up to the edge of World War III here. This is our president scolding Russia for nationalism when they're protesting our expanding NATO onto their borders, including now in Ukraine. Here's President Obama.
It only shows that unrestrained nationalism is the last refuge of those who cannot or will not deliver real progress and opportunity for their own people at home.
Which is a variation on the old cliche that false patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels. I think that was a Mark Twain quote, or maybe it was a Teddy Roosevelt quote, but it was back from that era, around the turn of the last century. So, anyhow, I have some concerns about that. I just wanted to put that on the record. Third time's the harm. Yet another plane diverted over legroom fight. This over at Mediaite. On Tuesday, yesterday, a United Airlines flight diverted over after two passengers fought for legroom. Oh, this was a week ago Tuesday. Somebody was using the knee defender, this thing that locks the seat in front of you so you can't recline the seat. And the person in front threw a glass of water on the guy behind her. Then yesterday, a fight broke out on, this is the great airplane seat reclining war of 2014. Josh Feldman is calling it over at Mediaite. This was a Florida woman on a flight from LaGuardia to West Palm Beach on Delta. And the person in front of her reclined their seat and hit her head. Apparently, this woman was trying to sleep with her head on the fold-down seat. And she reportedly told one of the flight attendants to eat doo-doo and die. I'm paraphrasing to make it legal. And she told police that two of her dogs recently died. She's very emotional. And the person ahead of her reclined her seat was an older woman who was knitting. So, I mean, this is like three incidents in the last week. And what I find interesting is that the way the press is playing this is, you know, how dare these unruly people? Now, keep in mind, the press in the United States is by and large big corporations, billion-dollar corporations. The airlines are big corporations, billion-dollar corporations. The press has more in common with the airlines than they do with the traveling public who flies in coach. I think the question should be, why aren't the airlines providing more legroom? I mean, I don't know the policies of all the airlines. I know that United will sell you more legroom. You can go to Economy Plus, I think they call it, for an extra 35, 40, 50 bucks, something like that, per flight. But It's almost like, hey, let's squeeze people in and make life really miserable and then sell them an option out of that. And for those people who can't afford the first class option, which is two or three times the price of the entire seat, you know, instead of a $500 flight, you're now looking at a $1,500 or $2,000 flight in first class. Instead of that, we'll give them just an extra 4 inches or whatever it is, a legroom for 35 bucks. And It raises an interesting question. I mean, if somebody wants to save money and fly in coach, then should they be expected to put up with, you know, if they're over 5'10", not being able, you know, basically not being able to sit in the seat? Or have the airlines gone too far? I mean, have we just reached the point in the United States where big corporations, I mean, you know, the credit card companies are screwing us. They're nickel and diming us. The banks are screwing us. The name an industry. The phone company is screwing us. The cable companies are screwing us. You compare us to other countries where we don't have, where there, these giant market monopolies don't exist, where competition is actually enforced by the government. In most European countries, the company that brings the copper into your house has to sell access to it to other companies for internet, for example. So there's competition. And our airlines now, you know, since Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, we've seen consolidation after consolidation after consolidation. United absorbed Continental, which had absorbed Eastern. We're down to like three or four major, maybe five major airlines, and they're all basically oligarchies. I mean, they're all, you know, they're not monopolies, but they're damn close. They're triopolies or quadopolies. And it's functionally the same thing. One does something, all the others follow in suit. If the first one doesn't get too much blowback. Is it time to start breaking up big business in America?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Because, you know, there's a limited number of airline slots in the airports, and the airlines pay dearly for these things. It's a really, really high cost of entry for new players. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, and every U.S. military base in the world. Simulcast has television on both Dish Network and DirecTV, on cable systems nationwide, and on Progressive Voices on TuneIn Radio. Congressman Alan Grayson on the line with us, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, a Democrat from Florida representing the 9th District, a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. His website, grayson.house.gov, and congressman with guts.com. Congressman Grayson, welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be on your show again.
Thanks for joining us. I understand that you have unilaterally, I guess, reached out to the ambassadors of several of the countries, many of the countries that surround Iraq, including Iraq, about putting together a multilateral force to deal with ISIS. Do I have that right?
Yes, I sent letters last week to the ambassadors of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the UAE, Oman, Yemen, Jordan, Egypt, Turkey, Algeria, and Morocco, asking them individually if countries would be willing to contribute a force of at least 5,000 soldiers to attack and defeat ISIS in Iraq. I also reached out to the ambassador to Iraq to see whether Iraq would entertain such a force within its borders.
And have you gotten a response from anybody?
Yes, two of the ambassador's staffs wrote back and said they will be giving a detailed response. We haven't heard from the other eight yet.
Okay.
We gave them until the 10th to respond. That's a week from today.
Right. I'm wondering how, you know, for example, you reached out to the Saudis. Steve Clemens wrote a great piece in The Atlantic I think it was in June, and he starts it out with John McCain telling Candy Crowley in January, thank God for the Saudis and Prince Bandar and our Qatari friends, talking about how he and Lindsey Graham, I guess, I don't know if they went over to Saudi Arabia or did it by telephone, but they got together with Prince Bandar and said, we need to arm the Sunni insurgency in Syria. And Prince Bandar got together a bunch of rich Saudis and they threw a whole bunch of money to the Salafis, the you know, closely aligned Sunnis with Saudi Arabia. And those people essentially became ISIS, according to this article. If we've got, you know, senators promoting, don't we have a problem here with some of these countries?
Well, history repeats itself first as tragedy and then as farce.
Yeah.
We had the same origin for Osama bin Laden, didn't we?
You're right. Yeah, going into Afghanistan and you know, aligning ourselves with these people.
By the way, am I allowed to repeat Karl Marx in the air? I'm not.
You sure. Certainly.
Oh, it's okay?
Yes, of course.
On your show, it's okay?
Yes.
All right, good then. I want to make sure I'm not offending anybody.
No, I think Marx's analysis of capitalism is right. I think his solutions were wrong, but I think, you know, Capital still stands as a great analysis of the problems of laissez-faire capitalism. You had a quote you wanted to share?
I just did. That was actually Karl Marx who said history repeats itself first as tragedy and then as farce.
Ah, okay. I'm sorry I didn't recognize the quote.
And in this case, it is a farce because we haven't learned our own lessons. A lot of the grief that we've come to in the Middle East for the past 20 years has been a product of our own making. I think that the war in Iraq is the ultimate example of that. $4 trillion down that rat hole, and now we have people who are anxious for us to do it all over again. It's funny. I listen carefully to what the other side has to say. Right now, they're telling us that we should have attacked Assad last year, and therefore we should attack Assad's opponents, ISIS, this year. And that doesn't correspond to any definition of the word therefore that I'm familiar with, but there it is.
Yeah. So
they simply won't learn from their mistakes, starting with Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, these being the neoconservatives in our government and our, you know, whatnot. How to frame this question? Colin Powell warned George W. Bush about the pottery barn rules. You break it, you own it. George W. Bush said, I don't care about that. I'm going to break it. He broke it. and never tried to do the you own it, which presumably means you get to glue those pieces back together, throughout his presidency. He basically dumped that job on Obama. President Obama got our troops out of Iraq, but didn't do any gluing it back together. There were still, 2.5 million refugees and hundreds of thousands of dead people and an infrastructure that had been savaged and ravaged. I think we could agree on the kind of damage that the Bush administration did to the region, and now we've got other failed states. Libya is turning into a failed state now as a result of similar policies. What specifically are you suggesting that we do?
Well, first, I think we should stop engaging in bad metaphors. That's always a good start in politics because they come fast and furious. I don't think the correct metaphor is pottery. I think the correct metaphor is Humpty Dumpty.
Right.
It's never going to go back to the way it was. We can't do it. It's not possible. He sat on the wall and he had a great fall, and we're never going to be able to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. That's not possible. You cannot rewind history. It doesn't work that way. But what I'm suggesting is that instead of our indulging ourselves with a missile attack there and a bombing here and a drone attack here and there, instead we come up with an organized plan to galvanize the local support that we have against savagery, against beheading, against other forms of lunacy, and have them solve their own problems. These are people. These are countries that are at least espoused to be our allies: Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, UAE, Oman, and so on. We actually reversed invasion and occupation. It was something, and we have protected Saudi Arabia and the UAE for a generation or more from outside attacks. Maybe these countries should actually work to solve their own regional problems. I don't understand why people think that we must all the time always be the world's police officer, and no one else has any role in this. Obviously, people all around the world are, how should I put this, repelled by the sights that they've seen by ISIS, not just Americans, not even just Europeans and Americans, but people all around the world. Why can't we act unilaterally and give special responsibility to these Sunni-ruled countries in the region to solve this problem?
Yeah.
I think that we've already seen that Iraq has no will to fight. That itself is a shame. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, there was one circumstance where ISIS came upon an Iraqi town and announced through bullhorn that they were going to occupy the town, and all the Iraqi soldiers fled. So a bullhorn is now a weapon of mass destruction. There was another circumstance where they were about to occupy another Iraqi town. They got the telephone number for the local army base. They called them up and said, hey, we're coming in a few hours, and all the Iraqi soldiers fled. So we've now established as a fact that Iraq, a country with $100 billion a year in oil revenue, $100 billion a year in oil revenue, and a 1-million-man armed force that we created and trained for the course of 10 years at the cost of $4 trillion, 4,000 American lives. We've now established that that country is unable to defend itself and is now occupied, or at least a third of it is now occupied, by a ragtag band of a few hundred lunatics, ISIS. The Iraqi army out by 4-1 and lost that battle. It lost it. So now the question is, is there anybody in the entire region, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the UAE, Oman, Yemen, Jordan, Egypt, and so on, anybody who's willing to stand up to ISIS?
Now,
I'm hoping that the answer is yes. I'm hoping that they step forward and actually do what I'm suggesting that they do. I'm hoping the Iraqis accept help. But what does it tell us if they won't? What does it tell us if Iraq won't defend its own borders? If Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, UAE, Oman, all Sunni countries, with facing a Sunni problem, these ISIS forces are Sunni fundamentalists. What does it tell us if they won't do anything about it either? Why do we have to solve their problems for them? Why won't they step up?
Might it be that what it tells us is that the government in Iraq under Maliki aligned itself with Iran when we left? Actually, even before we left, the first major business that opened in downtown Baghdad was the Bank of Tehran. That this largely Shiite government in Iraq had purged its military and purged its all the cabinet members. It pretty much purged all the Sunnis out. And there's a fair amount of evidence that at least half of ISIS in Iraq is made up of former police officers and military officers from the old Iraq army, who may not be crazies, but they just don't, you know, they're not up for Sunnis or Shias running their government.
I understand that, but then the question remains, why is an Iraqi army that has something on the order of 600,000 Shias with arms? What, and that includes the local police forces. Why is an Iraqi army with 600,000 Shias under arms and led by Shia generals still unwilling to fight? Right. Why is it, for instance, that you see Hezbollah fighting to defend the Syrian regime, which is Alawite slash Shiite in Syria, but not fighting to defend the Iraqi Shia regime in Iraq? Why is it that Iran is not sending troops into Iraq to fight ISIS? What's going on here? What's going on?
We have just 20, 30 seconds. What do you think is going on?
I think what's going on is that Uncle Sam has become Uncle Sucker. Everybody thinks that we're going to solve all their problems for them, and we have to get out of that habit. We are in a bad, bad rut here, and we have to get out of it. Yeah. Either they're going to have to learn how to defend themselves, or they're going to have to lose on their own.
I'm with you.
No, I see it.
Congressman Alan Grayson, congressman with guts.com, grayson.house.gov. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Always a pleasure talking. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
Well, that's a refreshing perspective. Gee, U.S., policemen of the world? Nah, don't think so. Police your own planet, or your own corner of it. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ray in Van Buren, Arkansas, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV system. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Not much. It's good. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Tom.
Thank you.
Yeah, Congressman Grayson, I just wanted to say real quick, put the situation in that region in the Middle East quite succinctly. And he definitely elucidated the problems that the United States faces, and that we definitely need a multilateral approach so that the U.S. won't be seen as being on the side of Assad or the Shiites, which would further engross the region in a more partisan divide between the Sunnis and Shiites that we presently see.
Right.
What I wanted to say real quick is we see two memes that are being proffered right now, vis-a-vis either reporters talking to Rear Admiral John Kirby or Jan Psaki yesterday, and this was picked up by Fox News hosts and guests and then made its way to the Chicken Hawk Talk Radio. And it's basically this, is that the first meme that we see being proffered is that the Republicans don't want to put their name on the dotted line, per se. They're saying that the people on Fox News, their hosts and the others, are saying that to Jan Psaki and to Rear Admiral John Kirby, they picked it up and said, why doesn't Obama just say that we're at war? We're at war, and they put this forward to Jan Psaki and Rear Admiral John Kirby both. And what they're trying to do is it looks like they're trying to provide cover for the Republican Party so that the Republican Party can hide behind the War Powers Act.
Right.
Instead of doing what Senator Nelson is saying, is put your name on the dotted line and authorize Obama to act.
Right, because only Congress can declare a war. The reason the president's not
right.
saying we're at war is because Congress has not declared a war. And he provided them
right.
with an opportunity to do that a year ago, by the way, with regard to Syria, and they passed.
Right. Last year, President Obama was like, authorized me to strike in Syria, and Congress reneged on it and didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And we're seeing a second meme that is in tow with this first meme, is that they're like, no, you have the authority to strike under the War Powers Act, and we can see that they're hiding behind it, and they're wanting him or one of his surrogates to say that we're at war so they can facilitate hiding behind it.
Right.
And the second meme that is in tow with that first meme is that President Obama, basically, he laid out a three-part plan, and this was reiterated by Rear Admiral John Kirby. And what it was is that we need to continue the airstrikes in Iraq, no boots on the ground, and facilitate a culturally inclusive method after Maliki was ousted, and to facilitate a culturally inclusive plan so that the political situation in Iraq can be stabilized, and then arm the Kurds, which right now Britain has said that they are going to send heavy arms to the Kurds. Australia said that they're going to send arms to the Kurds. We are arming the Kurds and the Iraqi military with more heavy weaponry.
Right. And then the third part we're just about out of time here, Ray.
Yeah, and so what I'll say real quick. So what it is that he's aiming for, President Obama is aiming for the FSA, the Kurds, the Iraqis, and as your guest just said a minute ago, we need the Sunnis to take on the Sunnis.
Right. What's the FSA? The Free Syrian Army. Right, got it. Ray, thank you very much for the call. Excellent analysis. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I'd like to say I like what Ray had to say, and it's probably leading into what I was going to say anyway. But even the politics within that as well is that you would have, first of all, Obama did want to go as far as September of last year and do limited airstrikes, and the Congress opposed him.
Right.
So let's get that clear, because, you know, there was a true and immediate danger that he saw, although he was really saying the chemical weapons he didn't want it to get in the hands of, you know, terrorists.
Right.
But I'm sure he had a loose agenda, you know, it wasn't just that.
Well, not only that, Charles, I mean, you're responding to this narrative that's making its way across Fox News and the right-wing radio sphere that why doesn't Obama just say we're at war with ISIS? And the answer, the very simple answer is that only Congress has the power to declare war. The president can't just declare a war unless, at least not on another country or other people. They might declare a war on drugs or poverty or something, but, you know, without Congress, and arguably without Congress, they can't even do drugs or poverty a war on. But the fact of the matter is that a year ago, President Obama said to Congress, I would like to bomb Syria. I'm all ready to bomb Syria. We've got all the assets in the region positioned to bomb Syria. Please give us the authorization. And they said no. And now a year later, they're all whining and freaked out that, you know, he's not bombing Syria. Back to you, Charles.
Right. Exactly. And with the politics and that as well, is you would have a black man ordering kids that's in charter school, kids that they don't want to have, you know, that they are claiming that they don't need to eat those healthy lunches from, you know, Michelle Obama. So it's a politics as well. It's a black man actually leading this country in the war. And I think once you get past that level, you know, then you put us on, as far as racial divide, you put us on the same plane as the white man. And I think that's the biggest hurdle. It's the politics within the politics, you know, of what they're doing.
Well, for a large chunk of the
divided.
Yeah, for a large chunk of the Republican Party, it's not that they object to his tan suit; it's that they object to a tan president.
Exactly. You know, exactly. So the whole thing is, you know, it's killing me right now to listen to Fox and even CNN and say that we don't have a strategy. To be honest with you, if he did say that we had a strategy last week and they killed Sotloff, they'd have been blaming the president. They'd have been saying, well, if he didn't have said that,
right,
then Sotloff may still be alive. So there's no win in this situation. And, of course, we can't talk about jobs right now.
Yeah.
And one more important thing, please. President Obama's statement today, he said how Russia was declining as far as the economy. And, you know, the ruble, I think, was one of the lowest rates. Well, this is what you get from conservative presidents. You know, and this is what you get from a George Bush regime as well. As you saw, our economy declined. We actually just exploded as far as the housing was concerned, and we're in this depression now. So this is what you're going to get, even when you look at the UK, and they went to that system where they held back on all their public obligations. Their economy retracted as well.
Yeah.
So this is what we're looking forward to if we...
Yeah, and this is what's happening in the states that are run by Republicans, where they're using... austerity economics. Excellent points, Charles. All. Thank you very much for the call. Rich in Jefferson City, Missouri. Hey, Rich. You want to talk about the oligarchs?
Yeah. I always had I've actually called about this before, but the main problem that we have is society, we really don't have any say over the economic structure. So Right. I always considered consumer unions, consumption, controlling consumption, and controlling the markets, you know, through consumption and unionizing it, like a labor union. But instead of labor, which I believe is very vulnerable to the economic system that we have, right. Consumption, you know, if you control consumption, which you can't replace a consumer.
Here's the problem with consumer unions. If you put together a consumer union to say, you know, we're only going to buy from local companies, we're only going to buy from small companies, we're only going to buy, you know, that kind of thing, the things that encourage local economies and a strong economy rather than supporting the oligarchs, and you walk into your shopping center or your downtown area, can you find one business?
No, well, yeah, but...
I mean, this is the legacy of Reagan stopping his enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1982. Since then, you've had all these businesses combined to the point where they've wiped out the retail sector in America. You've got fewer than 10 companies that control more than 90% of all the food we eat. I mean, go ahead.
That's the point. That's the point I'm making, is that we are left to, like, in a town of 10,000, they have a Walmart,
right?
And they might have like a Walgreens. If you have a system, I mean, what did they do before Walgreens existed or Walmart existed? There were stores, and they would
sure.
come back. It would have to be practical.
But you have to move the Walmart out of the equation. I mean, every time a Walmart opens, roughly 140 stores over the next couple of years will go out of business,
right.
Local businesses.
Right. That's exactly my point. Is if you can facilitate a consumption, you know, if you can hold back consumption, you can put something out.
Yeah, but you can't. People need to eat. People need, you know, the things break. They need to go to the store and get replacements.
Right. But there's still enough. I mean, every little town has an alternative market, you know, somewhere or not far away.
Yeah, the farmers market are a small part. I think that the problem has to be addressed on the larger systemic, which is the antitrust provisions. We need to start enforcing the antitrust laws again in this country and mandating competition. I mean, if we give all this lip service to competition and then, you know, our government's policy ever since 1981 has been to reduce competition for big companies. And it's, you know, whether it's using the copyright and trademark laws and patent laws, or which are, you know, way overbroad in my mind, particularly with the millennial digital copyright, or whether it's, you know, the merger of companies to the point where they, you know, a small number of companies eat entire industries. We've got to break those up, and that has to be done at the level of government.
But you can control that through consolidation of the people, just like they use the Business Roundtable or ALEC as a collective organization to go against the majority. The majority could use that same system to fight back. I don't see.
I in theory, I don't disagree with you. I just don't see most people sitting around, you know, saying, gee, I think we've got a few extra hours this week. Let's participate with the consumer co-op. But I don't know. We'll see. Rich, excuse me. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. You raise an interesting point. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. One of the interesting debates that's going on is whether we should be supporting working people in the United States by providing free preschool or daycare or whatever you want to call it, Head Start, by providing a place for working parents to drop their kids during the day. So, because we've got, you know, half of all children today in America come home to an empty home. Phyllis Schlafly is on the line with us, author, speaker, founder of the Eagle Forum. EagleForum.org is her website. Her Twitter is at Phyllis Schlafly and at Eagle Forum. Ms. Schlafly, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Always good to join you.
Thank you. You wrote this piece, this op-ed for Eagle Forum, titled The Dead End Road Called Pre-K. And you want to make your argument?
Well, there has been a tremendous effort by the feminists to have the government, the taxpayers, take over the care of preschool children. The feminists tell their people that the care of small children is really demeaning because it's not worthy of the time of an educated woman. And so they have had many major efforts to give us baby care, daycare, whatever you want to call it, babysitting. And now they have come up with a new name, pre-K, and they want to get all four-year-olds in. And there is absolutely no scientific backup for that being helpful to the kids. Well, you'd think they would be able to cite examples that show that kids do better when they're brought into an organized school setting at age four, but there's no evidence that says that.
Well, actually, there is. There are a number of studies, both long-term and short-term. They've been done in Michigan, New Jersey, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and West Virginia. The
ones they usually cite are 50 years old.
Yeah, the major longitudinal studies, which began in the 60s and 70s, but they're continuing to this day, are the High Scope Perry Preschool Project, the Chicago Parent Center, and the Akabadarian Project. All three of these are 50-year-long studies that show, for example, with pre-K, IQ was over 90 at age of 5, 67%, without pre-K, 28%. Achieved basic or better at the age of 14, 49% with pre-K, 15% without. This is among low-income, at-risk children. Graduated high school with pre-K, 65%, without 45%. Owned a home at the age of 27, 27% with pre-K, 5% without pre-K. Earned over $40,000, over $20,000 at the age of 40, 60% with pre-K, 40% without. That's from the High Scope Perry Preschool Study. Through the age of 40. They track these children for 40 years. You're right. And, I think that's pretty good science. But beyond that, you made two points. One was that the government wants to take over preschool education. I don't know of any programs where the government actually owns the facilities and hires the teachers. I think it's government would fund it. And if not the government, then who? I mean, back in the 80s, I ran a business. My wife and I owned and ran a business, and we actually had a daycare center in our business, because it was a travel agency, and a lot of the people who worked for us were young women who had children. We offered that as a benefit, but that was, back before Reaganomics had really taken hold, and the middle class had been hit so badly. Now you can't make a living. I mean, in some countries like Sweden, they actually say, okay, staying at home is worth a certain amount of money, and you can take this you can get it as a tax deduction, you can get it as you are eligible for Social Security. We put money into your retirement fund as a stay-at-home mom or dad. But I don't hear Republicans promoting any of those things.
Well, the Republicans in general don't want to spend more money and don't want the government controlling more of our lives and raising our children. And in those studies, you haven't compared them with the advantage of children who live with their own mother and father and are cared for at home.
It's obviously the optimal.
A four-year-old is too young to be put in a school setting. I don't think it's good for the child. I don't think a child benefits by it. And I really question all those figures that you put out, because what they talk about all the time are the Head Start and the Perry Project, which, of course, have never been replicated, And we need to know, we need to have some really good facts.
But even let's set all that aside. Let's say that the this argument about whether, and in fact, philosophically, I have to tell you, Phyllis Schlafly, I agree with you that the optimal place for a child, and I would say in the first 7 years of their life, I think we should adopt the Swedish model and not send kids off to school until they're seven years old.
Well, I do too.
Is it home?
A parent ought to teach the child how to read before she dares to let the child in school, because the school is not going to teach the child to read.
Yeah. Well, but so we can, you know, philosophically we can say it's the best thing for the child to stay at home with mom or mom and dad or dad. But the reality of, you know, post-Reaganomics America is that we have had flat income. The average worker, household income has gone from $25,000 a year up to around $44,000 a year since the Reagan administration. But that's because we've gone from 1.1 worker in the workplace in 1980 to 2.3 workers in the workplace right now. It's, you know, first mom started working part-time, now mom's working full-time, and now dad's taking a second job. And so there's just no time for the kids. This, I agree with you, is a tragedy for us, but shouldn't we be addressing this systemically? Shouldn't we be saying that all work has a modicum of a minimum level of dignity associated with it that should allow people to have at least a living wage? And therefore, like this tragedy, this poor young woman in Florida, I think she was a couple of days ago, who died in her car, asleep in her car. She was working four jobs. And she died in her car because there was a gasoline can in the back, because she had run out of gas driving between jobs before, and the fumes in the gas can killed her. I mean, she was trying to catch a couple of Z's between jobs. Shouldn't we say one job is enough to support a family?
Well, I just don't think the government should be our babysitter and make decisions like that for people. I'm sorry if she was working four jobs, but I don't think it's the government's job to tell her how many jobs she can take.
No, I don't either. But
how many people are stuck with part-time jobs now? The number of full-time jobs has really reduced in our country in the last couple of years due to government regulations.
Well, I think it's been due to our trade policies that have put every American worker in competition with a Chinese worker. And you know, maybe we agree on that. I'm not suggesting that the government should be telling individuals what, you know, what they're earning. I'm suggesting that if an employer wants to go to the government and say, I want limitations from liability, I want the ability to deduct the CEO's lunch tab from the taxes of the corporation. If they're going to do that kind of thing, they should also, in exchange for that, they should say, we will pay a living wage so that our workers are, so that an individual worker working in our business can support a family. What's wrong with that?
Well, I'm in favor of a living wage, but I'm not in favor of the government setting wages. And I think that's what you're heading toward, which I don't think is what we want in a free society.
But that, you know, how can, you know, Franklin Roosevelt famously said, a necessitous man is not a free man. If somebody can't afford their rent and for food, how are they free?
Well, you know, when we had a good middle class and people could support their own family with a full-time homemaker in the home, we had very few government regulations.
Yeah, life was a lot better.
When the government got into the picture, it's the nanny state to take care of the kids.
Yeah.
Because somebody has to take care of them.
Okay, I get your perspective.
I suggest that your listeners can go to my website, eaglefarm.org, and get some more information.
There you go. I was just about to say the same thing. Eaglefarm.org is Phyllis Schlafly's website. You can read her piece. It's called The Dead End Road to Pre-K. Call Pre-K. Phyllis Schlafly, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks. Have a good day.
Thanks. You too. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Your thoughts on how we should deal with this? Seems to me like, you know, once again, we're getting screwed by the man. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Tom in Kalkaska, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Well, you know, I was thinking it's about time for us to go back to old-fashioned ways of doing things. If we're going to fly on those planes in passenger, you know, wherever, you know, the cheap seats, don't do it.
Yeah, I remember when the cheap seats used to be comfortable. I mean, I started flying around the world in the 70s, and the cheap seats were great. I flew to Europe a whole bunch of times, and you could even flip up the armrests, you know, and lay down on a bunch of them and on those overnight flights. And now even that's gone away. It's just like there's nothing anymore. It's amazing.
I'd even fly them. I don't ride in them anyway. I don't care.
Yeah, well, you know, some of us have to get from place to place from time to time, and there's a lot of people who make their living doing that, and a lot of people whose, you know, their families are scattered all over the country, and so if they want to see them, they have to hop on an airplane. And should that be an ordeal? I mean, should it be an ordeal with TSA? Should it be an ordeal with the seats? I think that we need to de-ordealize our flight.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah,
maybe,
there you go.
Fast railroad would work much better.
Yeah.
I think the records with the airplanes even.
In fact, you know, I mentioned yesterday that movie Watermelon Man, which was made in 1970, so it was actually filmed in 1969-70. In the movie, after the character the character that is named Jeff in the movie, after he goes from being a white guy to being a black guy, and his wife, just before his wife leaves him, she sends the kids back to Indiana to be home, and they're presumably living in Los Angeles. They put them on Amtrak. She put the kids, and this is like a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old, she put the kids on Amtrak all alone and said, my parents are going to meet them tomorrow morning when the train arrives. Back in 69-70, we had a national rail system. It was called Amtrak. You could go, you know, not anywhere in the United States, but you could go a lot of places in the United States. It's been more than cut by at least half, and probably more like three quarters, and it's been replaced with these monopolistic airlines. It's very, very screwed up. So I'm with you, Tom. I'm with you.
Good boycott of the airlines would really solve a lot of problems as far as transportation. You know, Congress can't make them planes fly, and first class is not enough passengers.
Yeah. Well, and that's true. And although the first class passengers have to be profitable for the airlines, or they wouldn't be doing it.
I don't think that's enough money to fund the transportation, though.
On the other hand, you know, if you look at some of the discount airlines, and I guess Southwest and JetBlue are pretty much the only ones left, they don't have such a legroom problem, I don't believe. I've flown on both airlines in the last couple of years, and I don't recall thinking, oh, my God, I'm really crammed in here. But I'd have to go back and look at a comparison. It's you know, that's a purely anecdotal perspective, and I should get some data on it. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. I'm with you. It's time to bring back the old airlines and the you know, the idea that if you're going to fly, you deserve a decent seat and a meal. Now it's, if you're going to fly, hey, it's an opportunity, and we can get an extra $35 for a better seat. We can get an extra $25 for a bag. We can get an extra $50 for, oh, you want to be boarded first so that you're sure that to get an overhead compartment for your carry-on bag. I mean, it's like they're. Oh, you want a glass of water? That's an extra $5. It's mind-boggling. 20 minutes past. And it's always interesting to talk to Phyllis Schlafly. It's funny. She's one of the most outspoken old-fashioned right-wingers out there. You know, very much kind of America should be Beaver Cleaver world. And I get that. I don't agree with it, but I get it. I understand where she's coming from, and it startles me every now and then when she gets on and I'll say something and she says, I agree with that. I'm like, you know, are these crazy free trade policies? She's like, I agree with that. Tilt. You know, judicial review. Last time she was on, I'm like, you know, the Supreme Court's gone nuts. And she's like, I agree with that. I wrote a book about that. So anyway, I just find it interesting. Very interesting. Jerry in Woodbury, New Jersey. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I listened to your speaker, and I just totally disagree with her. We have three children. The last one just finished pre-K. All three went into the same pre-K, and it gave them tremendous social skills.
Yeah.
And my wife works from home, and I disagree with you. to the age of about three, my wife was at home with the kids, but then the daycare center, the quote unquote pre-K, gave them, more, there was three or four, teachers, if you will, that were involved with each child, that they interacted with, they handled three or four different classes, and the teachers moved from class to class, teaching them different skills. And our children have no behavioral problems in school. The last one is going into kindergarten tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And they were as sad as could be at that daycare center because he was the last. And that cost us $1,100 a month. And that's not money we could have, with my wife working at home, we could have left them at home. But after the experience with the first child and how well he did, we decided to, it was an investment for us. That was $1,100 out of our pocket. And I believe that, I do agree with you that daycare should be, and somehow we should be able to provide for that.
Would you disagree, Jerry, with the assertion that if we had a guaranteed minimum wage in the United States, so everybody made at least $30,000 a year, or a guaranteed minimum income, excuse me, everybody gets $30,000 a year, period, and now you can choose to work or not to work.
I totally agree with that. I am a union electrician out of Philadelphia. I also drive a truck over the road, so I've worked union and non-union. We live the best one when I'm working union. And here's one thing that I think we all need to be aware of. People have to stop saying the government, like it's someone else. If you have a complaint about the government, that's your government. That's not Great Britain's or Russia's or somebody else. That's your government. Ask yourself, when's the last time you've been to a town meeting? When's the last time, as union members, you've been to a union meeting? When's the last time you got involved in your local politics? Because if you did, there would be a living wage in your hometown, like those towns, I believe, isn't it Washington that has raised their minimum wage substantially? Seattle State?
Yeah, it's not Washington State. Washington State has done that, but Seattle raised it to $15 an hour, yeah.
That's bare bones, Tom. That's not quote-unquote living. That's
a minimum wage, not a living wage. I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. Jerry, well said. Thank you very, very much for the call. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, you wanted to talk about war without end and economies?
Yeah. Let me get a quick one in on Mr. Grayson. He says we need to leave these people to their own devices in the Middle East. If he has a solution to the economic hitmen that the oligarchs have, then his idea might work. Real quick. Bin Laden says he want to drain the evil empires. I think he plays into the hands of the rich using war to get rid of the restless natives. If we have an unsustainable economy, you need endless war to keep it going. So that kind of like bump heads there, and we – us progressives need to realize it by saying, okay, let's don't go to war, you know, to make Bin Laden happy. But then we used to use war to keep the economy going. But yet, you know, we're getting rid of a lot of restless natives for no reason at all. And we need to be smart to this because, and then on top of that, we can't cover the earth with concrete and high rises or whatever to keep the economy going. So we need to start focusing on a recyclable economy. Mm-hmm. And the solution, nationalizing our money, stop giving it to the people who are screwing us. So, you know, that's pretty much my comment.
Yeah. Okay. Well said. Jesse, thanks a lot for the call. I agree. I'm right across the board. And we're hitting a break. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Your thoughts on what we should be doing in Iraq, what we should be doing in Syria, what we should be doing in Ukraine. I think you know my opinions on all of these things fairly clearly now. And what we should be doing with regard to daycare in the United States. I see the daycare argument as a small piece of a much larger one, which is about wages.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I see that as a small argument inside a larger argument about rolling back Reaganomics, rolling back the Reagan tax cuts, and rolling back Reagan's war on working people. The latest, by the way, just FYI, social news, but also a consider this. The latest in the hacked celebrity photos thing is that some of these women were underage, and so now these websites are sitting on illegal content. They're scrambling on that. I think that the content should be illegal right from the get-go. This is something that, as a society, as a culture, we principally do to women. It advances the idea that women are objects, that it's just wrong. In addition, it looks like the way that they got this, the way that these hackers were successful in getting this information from these famous women's accounts, was by using the fact that the Apple Find My Computer, Find My iPhone app, you could try to log in. Most sites, if you log in badly three times, it locks the site, and it sends you an email saying your site has been locked. With Apple, with that particular site, you could try it over and over and over and over and over again. So they use these brute force hacking methods where you just throw 100,000 passwords at a site and eventually one gets through. Or a million passwords. I mean, there's programs that can generate these things faster than you can think. And Apple has fixed that in the last couple of days. But it shouldn't have been that way in the first place, A. And B, you know, I remember when cloud computing first started and everybody was like, oh, yeah, I got all my stuff on the cloud. And I'm like, I'm not putting my stuff on the cloud. It's like, you know, there's no such thing as the cloud. It's a computer someplace on planet Earth that is owned by a giant corporation. You know, are you going to put your information on Apple's computer? Are you going to put it on Microsoft's computer? Are you going to put it, whose computer are you going to put it on? But you're putting it on somebody's computer. Now, some of the companies that offer just exclusively backup service are really, really, really hysterical about security. I mean, you know, Carbonite, for example. I've met David Friend, the guy who started that company. They do a really good job of making sure that you're the only one who can get the information. But others, not so much. And so, anyhow, I think that there are several lessons here. Number one, as a society, we should be discussing how do we treat women. Number two, we need to deal with the legal issue of, if somebody takes your pictures and puts them out there, or somebody invades your privacy like that, what kind of legal recourse do you have? And should websites who put this stuff up be held responsible for it? I believe so. I mean, we were talking about copyrights yesterday. I mean, this is way beyond copyright. Somebody having nude photos of themselves on their computer that they didn't realize their computer automatically was backing up to the cloud every day, and so they're on the cloud. And all somebody has, they thought it was on their computer. It's like, you know, it's a giant wake-up call for all of us in a whole lot of regards. All that said, back to your calls. Robert in Cross Timbers, Missouri. Hey, Robert, you wanted to talk about Republicans and war? Robert is not on the phone. Michelle in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Michelle, airline seat rage?
Yes, airline seat rage. I found this very interesting too, and I see it as a metaphor for why pure libertarian, the libertarian paradise, socially and economically, is a failure. And I've got 3 points, if I may. First of all, if everyone pursued their maximum own self-interest, in this case, comfort in reclining seats, everybody would be fine, but when is the last time you've ever, in reality, ever seen that happen? That never happens.
Right.
The only time everyone is in concert with the, you know, where their seats are is when there's a regulation or a rule in place. That would be on takeoff and landing. Number two, what this ends up doing is since there are no rules outside of takeoff and landing, so now it's up to the individuals to figure it out amongst themselves, and unfortunately now we're seeing fights amongst the individuals, and they're fighting with each other instead of fighting with who's responsible for this in the first place. That would be the airlines, who created this design. And number three, just the fact that fights are in fact breaking out on, you know, over this sort of a thing, I think is a reflection of two things. One, it's a reflection of how we have in fact become conditioned to this libertarian concept of dog eat dog, me, me, me. And number two, it reflects the kind of stress that individuals feel under this kind of set of circumstances. It's a failure.
Right. And to your second and third point, there are some libertarian commentators who have been making the rounds, the circuit, saying that, well, if you want to recline your seat, you should turn around to the person behind you and say, I'll give you $25 if you won't object to my reclining the seat, or offer it to them if they do object. And this just further, for me, clarifies the fact that libertarians are, by and large, wealthy, white, and mostly men. And secondly, I'm concerned that the airlines, I mean, they're diverting these planes. They're punishing the entire, everybody on the plane gets punished because of the behavior of a couple of people. And I think that they think that by doing this, they're going to discourage people from having these fights because nobody wants to be responsible for diverting the plane. But it may well be that because we've had three of these now in 5 days, that what they're doing is they're causing America to scrutinize the airlines and say, oh, really? The seats are that bad? Maybe I don't want to fly. Maybe I will take Amtrak. Maybe I will drive. Maybe they're going to shoot themselves in the foot with this. Your thoughts?
Well, even at a more serious level, actually, I think the airlines are entirely responsible, and this is a place where regulations do need to come in and the government should step in because this is a safety issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a huge safety issue.
Yeah. How do people get out of their seats in case of an emergency, if the plane makes a landing, a crash landing or something, if they can hardly move, and particularly tall people? Maybe it's time
to... And it's a safety issue to each individual if the possibility exists that a physical altercation could break out. I mean, now you're not even... You have to scrutinize the person sitting next to you.
Right.
Is this person going to get very upset to the point of physical harm?
Right. So now if you're flying, the person sitting next to you, if it's a fight over the armrest, and I've...
Or that.
Yeah. Or the person sitting behind you, if it's a fight over the seat recline. Yeah, good point. Michelle, thank you very much. You raised a whole bunch of really good points around this. Thank you. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Tom. You know, I have to say, with all due respect to Mrs. Schlafly, I don't know that a 90-year-old woman telling young families what they have a right to expect from their government is really a relevant statement, a relevant thing. I have to tell you something. When I first started at Michigan State, 1978, first quarter, as you may recall, you had to have an American literature class.
Yeah.
And the only one that was open when I enrolled, because I enrolled so late, was Women in America, Women's Studies. So I had my introduction to Phyllis Schlafly in 1978.
Oh, that's interesting. That they were studying her?
Well, she was, of course, you know, part of the point counterpoint, you know, with Betty Friedan and
Phyllis Schlafly, yeah.
Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem and all the other women that we read, and Phyllis Schlafly was, yeah, of course, part of that survey. But, you know, she makes a classic mistake in this argument, and that is this. She seems to be making a parallel argument that it's not the role of government, and it's ineffective, this pre-K.
Right.
And she thinks one bolsters the other. But, in fact, the second one exposes the first as being her agenda. It's not the role of government. Well, wait a minute. If what she's saying is it's not the role of government because it's ineffective. But that's not right. First of all, we know it is effective. Pre-K education, as another caller indicated, what they try to argue is that, oh no, kids don't stay ahead; that they're being out front wears off by the time they get to the fourth or fifth grade. But that's because of the logjam of grade level curriculum.
Yeah,
they're not getting anything.
Well, and in fact, the one study that purports to find that fadeaway effect. Is the one that Phyllis Schlafly and everybody like her always quotes, and that one study has not been replicated, and it seems to be the outlier. The majority of studies... Go ahead, Paul.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That because they're not continually fed the diet of the accelerated program, they, of course, what else, if nobody keeps telling you, but all of these kids who go through the pre-K, they remain in the top half of their class.
Right.
And anybody who's in the top half of their class, all the way through school, anybody who's in the top half is capable of going faster.
Well, and the other frame that I never brought into the argument with Phyllis Schlafly and probably should have started with is that for every dollar of government money, our money, invested in a pre-K child, you, as a society, from taxes that they pay, additional taxes that they pay because they have a higher income as adults, society makes back between $7 and $11.
Right.
That's not called spending. That's called investing. And so, you know, if every dollar we invest now is going to bring back $7 to $11 20 years from now when that person, when that child hits the labor market and for the next 40 years of their working life, then it seems to me like this should be a no-brainer, which is why it is a no-brainer in most fully developed countries.
It is. It really is. And I'm convinced that if we fine-tune these pre-K programs, that we could actually have kids graduating when they're 16. I'm sure. Tom, I'm certain because I've done it. Kids should be learning basic, the beginnings of calculus when they're in the seventh grade.
Oh, I was. I was. I know what you're talking about. Absolutely. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with the Talk Radio News Service and your call. Oh, get ready. Our dentist, June Kim, is going to be on in the next hour taking your dental questions. Get ready for that. Everybody here making dentist jokes. Come on, guys. All right, let's see here. Channing in Indianapolis, Indiana, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. Hey, Channing, you wanted to talk about ISIS?
Yeah, you're talking about the pre-K, and you know, if Democrats and if Republicans, what's their argument against something like that?
And against pre-K,
how do we
government shouldn't be caring for your child, which is a specious argument.
How much is it going to cost, and how are we going to pay for it? Right? I mean,
yeah.
Isn't that what they say about everything?
Yeah.
How much is it going to cost, and how do we pay for it?
Right.
But when we're going to go to ISIS, when we're going to go and fight them, we're never going to ask these questions.
Right, right. Or when we're going to
how much are we going to spend, and how are we going to pay for it?
Right. And now we're deploying NATO forces to Poland. They're moving tanks and 600 troops to Poland and the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania for joint maneuvers in October. And Rapid Trident, this is this new deployment that's happening right now, will entail a first significant deployment of U.S. and other personnel to Ukraine since the crisis has erupted. We're ramping up the conflict potential here, and nobody's asking, how do we pay for that either?
But so if Obama goes and he goes to Congress, when he goes to Congress, he should say, this has to be revenue neutral. We have to find a way to pay for everything we do there.
Right.
If he does that, he sort of traps Republicans into saying, well, wait a minute, we can't do that.
Right.
We need to act right now. And it's sort of like it exposes the hypocrisy of this sort of thinking.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It really would.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I had a question also. With the Hastert rule in effect, when he goes to Congress with a war resolution, does he have to, like, have a Republican? Does he basically have to go through a Republican, or can he go through a Democrat, and then the Republicans basically vote within themselves whether they'll allow the Democratic resolution to come to the floor?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, the Hastert rule, which is not really a rule, it's simply a policy. It's not a House of Representatives rule. It's a Republican rule. And Denny Hastert, when he was Republican Speaker of the House, apparently came up with this idea, is that if the Republicans control the House of Representatives, the Speaker is like a funnel through which everything has to go. Every piece of legislation proposed on the floor of the House of Representatives after it gets out of committee has to, or even before it goes to committee, has to be approved at several steps along the way. The Speaker of the House approves the legislative agenda. And so he can keep things from being debated. He can keep things from making it even into committee. This is the case with the Medicare expansion, with the unemployment expansion. This is the case with Well, it's just a comprehensive immigration reform. There's a bunch of bills that are just sitting on John Boehner's desk. And so the Hastert rule is, if you don't have enough Republicans to pass this without a single Democratic vote, then you don't bring it to the floor. You know, in other words, if you don't have enough Republicans in favor of it. So that kind of presumes that, or assumes, I suppose, that there's a Republican sponsor to begin with. So, yeah, I think you're going to have to, they would have to find a Republican sponsor for it. Channing, thanks a lot for the call. It's been a while since we talked about the Hastert rule. Thanks for bringing it up. We'll be back with your calls and talk radio. Tom Harmon here with you. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org.
And I just got a call, and you will too, I think, from a man who is doing a documentary on Don Siegelman and jail. Oh, and I told him about what you were doing on the radio at freedon.org. Right. And he's very impressed and will be in touch with you, I think.
Great. Great.
Yes. Okay, well, President I think he just left. It was in Estonia. Right. He gave both a press conference and a speech. The speech was a little more ramped up than the press conference in terms of going after Russian President Putin.
Right.
But he said on NATO, well, first of all, the president of Estonia said that he's grateful for NATO and all this kind of stuff and Article 5, which means, you know, if you hit one member of NATO, you're hitting them all. And
it's
all
a World War One domino fall.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So he then said that, well, we face this all, this new security issue. The president said, now this is what I just couldn't believe he said, but he did. He said the sanctions we've applied so far have had a real effect on Russia. They have?
Well, their economy, the ruble against the dollar is at the worst it's been in a decade, and their economy, I think, has dropped 6%.
But the sanctions were so pinpointed to specific people.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
I think
there's
recession happening all over Europe.
Right, yes.
It's happening all over the world.
Right. I don't think that it's related to those pinpoint.
Good point. Yeah.
But, okay. So then the president makes a speech before he leaves Estonia today. And he said that, and it was really, I would say it was a rabble-rousing indirect aim at Russia on this one. He said, we're working to do even more. As I announced earlier, the initiative I propose is to bolster the American presence in Europe, which would include additional Air Force units and aircraft for training exercises here in the Nordic Baltic region with three of those allies.
Right. This is Operation Rapid Trident. And it says this will entail a first significant deployment of U.S. and other personnel to Ukraine since the crisis erupted. And gasoline meet match.
Right. And, for sure. And also, actually, as you know, President Putin, supposedly there was this deal made for him to withdraw his troops, but he says, these are not our troops.
Poroshenko's talking about. That's right.
And then what happened is he said he has a 7-point peace plan that he talked about today. And then what happened...
He being the president?
President Putin.
President Putin. Okay.
And it included really them with drawing their troops, but also Ukraine not moving ahead,
right.
The government of Ukraine, and sort of this whatever, and then the troops decided not to pay any attention to President Putin's plan.
What happened to Angela Merkel going over there and saying, you need to adopt a federalist, I have the paper here,
right.
You need a federalist solution, which is all that the separatists have been asking for, the ability to vote for their own states, state governors, the equivalent of states, their own mayors. All these offices are appointed
right.
from Kiev. What happened to that? I thought that that Poroshenko said, okay, cool, we'll do that. And now it sounds like
everybody's ignoring what Merkel said. They sort of agree, and then it falls apart. And I don't know why. But it's clear, I think, from what happened today, that although the United States would like to say that President Putin controls these people, he doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, he may have some influence, but the quote-unquote separatists, they are their own people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's...
And they were making this point for a long, long time. We don't want to become part of Russia, although it it may come to that. Now that over 800,000 refugees, you know, 100,000 people immediately displaced. I mean, it's if a couple hundred people. I mean, Kiev is bombing their own cities. And I see these reports on TV, you know, where it shows the bombing in Kiev, and they never identify, or the bombing in eastern Russia, and they never identify the fact that the vast majority of those bombs came from Kiev rather than from Russia. And I don't know why. It's like our media is like...
Well, we could go on and on about the media.
This is
okay.
Like 2003 in Iraq. I mean.
Right. So also, the president did talk about the killing of Steve Soltoloff. He said, we're not going to be intimidated. He said, and those who make the mistake of harming Americans will learn we will not forget that our reach is long and that justice is served. And then Secretary Kerry actually came out later, and he said that those murdered will actually be held accountable. And then in addition, yesterday, last night, they said they're going to send 350 more troops into the area, bringing it to about 1,000. These are boots on the ground.
Right. Right. Although they're not really boots on the ground because they're advisors. I heard that story in 1964. 1961, 2, 3.
That's what we were doing in Vietnam. Absolutely, yeah. Tom Hartman. Okay, Dr. Tom Hartman. CVS today has announced that it is CVS Health. Now, why would we be talking about that on national news? Well, the White House came out today because they're going to stop selling cigarettes, except for products that help people stop. And they said that this was a powerful example. So CVS got a big push from the White House today. Also, Somalia said that they're going to give al-Shabaab 45 days to take up the Somalia government's offer of surrender and unconditional amnesty and all that kind of stuff. The African Union is also supporting the Somalia government.
Wow, that's good.
Yes,
that's
that good.
We had Congressman Grayson on earlier. He's contacted a bunch of the governments in the region around Iraq and said, well, you each commit 5,000 troops to a multilateral, Middle Eastern, and it doesn't seem to be getting much response.
Now, I looked this up because I didn't know how to pronounce it. Minke whales is how you pronounce it. And Japan is going to resume the hunting of them, but they say now they were stopped because their, quote-unquote, research purposes weren't research purposes, but now they're saying they're back to research purposes.
Right.
They're going to step up the research purposes.
Yeah, Norway and Japan both play this game.
That's right, exactly. Time also reported today that there are some pesticides that may cause allergic reactions. It is streptomycin, which is actually an antibiotic.
Yeah.
And it's also used as a pesticide, and it has been causing allergic reactions, and there's a case reported.
Streptomycin is derived from bacteria.
Yes, it is. A man who served 30 years on death row in North Carolina for a murder he did not commit, he was taken, DNA evidence was taken away. He and his brother, he was 19 at the time, a forced confession.
Right.
And he has been left out of death row today.
Wow, that's great. And this guy was a person of color, too, and that, you know, another example of how people of color get railroaded.
Oh.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio
Thank
News.
Thank you.
Goatsfortheoldgoat.com, free-down.org. Thank
yes.
you, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And We tried this a month or so ago, and it really worked well. People really appreciated it, and I wanted to do it again. Dr. Joon Kim is with us. He's a doctor of dental surgery, a friend of mine, a dentist, and he's going to answer your questions about dentistry. It's like, you know, it's not very often that we get an opportunity to talk about these things, and a lot of people have questions, and a lot of people don't even have dental coverage in this country, which is insane. And Dr. Kim, welcome back.
Welcome.
Thank you for joining us. You had a story you wanted to start off with about
polyethylene. Yes.
In our toothpaste. Tell us about this.
Mm-hmm. Polyethylene is pretty much the same plastic used in grocery bags. Mm-hmm. And they're in a lot of toothpaste. I know Crest, definitely, they have majority of Crest products have them. And it's becoming an issue now because plastic really has no space in toothpaste at all. They're pretty much there just for one effect, to make the toothpaste sparkle. And Crest came out with a statement last month saying that they're going to start removing these plastics, pretty much polyethylene, in their toothpaste because it's becoming an issue where a lot of dentists are finding out that it's just like having popcorn in your teeth. They cause inflammation, they cause bleeding, and these small particles, these small blue particles in your toothpaste, they're getting lodged in between your sulcus, which is between your tooth and your gum, and they're causing a lot of inflammation issues.
So they become like a local foci, a local spot where bacteria can grow.
And sure. And it's your body reacts to a lot of foreign material, and plastic is obviously a foreign material. So when it gets stuck in there, the sulcus is about 3 millimeter, and usually when you toothbrush, you could only go about a millimeter of space. So the other 2 millimeter underneath your sulcus is taken care of by hygienists and your dentist. Right. And when it's left behind, it causes a lot of inflammations and bleeding, and it could cause to a periodontal defect down the road.
In other words, the bone and the tooth start disintegrating, yes. And you got a big, serious problem there. That's fascinating. And let me just say, if you have a question for Dr. Kim, 877-987-THOM is our telephone number, and he will be taking your questions. You were going to say something
else? Yes. So whenever you get your toothpaste, make sure that they don't have polyethylene in it.
Right.
It's not going to be in your active ingredient. It's going to be in your other ingredient about 5 or 6 down the road, because they usually name it by what's more in the material. In
right.
It's more in the
polyethylene. Polyethylene and polystyrene are the two original kind of major mm-hmm. market plastics.
Mm-hmm. They are.
And this is, I didn't realize it was just the blue.
Just the blue stuff in your toothpaste, or anything that sparkles, anything that's kind of grainy. You want to make sure that when you look at your toothpaste, it's not going to be in the toothpaste tube. It's actually going to be in the box that it's in.
Right.
So make sure you look at and make sure you don't. It doesn't have any polyethylene in it.
Right. So just don't buy that stuff. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Is actually very hard if you actually look into it.
Really?
Yes. It's very hard to find one without polyethylene.
Wow. I've been using for years a toothpaste called Squiggle. It's 35% xylitol. It's mm-hmm. basically just xylitol with calcium as a grit agent, I mm-hmm. suppose. And because years ago I read this article about how xylitol kills the bacteria that causes, you know, and mm-hmm. it's totally neutral for us. It's a sugar. Mm-hmm. It's an alcohol, actually. Mm-hmm. The body metabolizes it as an alcohol, but it's not hard on the liver.
Yeah, it's the only anti-cariogen, which means it kills bacteria. It kills caries.
So why don't all toothpaste have xylitol?
I think they do. They're starting to move on to that trend where they're adding xylitol into
more
it.
More and more.
I think
this stuff is like literally 35%. I, you know, mm-hmm. before I found this, after I read that article, I think it was more than a decade ago. It was quite some time ago. And I read that article, and I found a local chemical supply store mm-hmm. that sold xylitol by the pound.
Wow.
I bought a pound of powdered xylitol, and I would just, you know, like the old dip your teeth in the baking soda and brush uh-huh. with them. I used to do that with the xylitol. And my dentist was all excited about it, and he asked me to get him a pound of it, and I got him a pound of it.
Oh, wow.
It's just so anyway, I don't know if I have benefited from it or not. But anyway, let's pick up some calls, some questions here. Scott in San Diego, you're on the air with Dr. Joon Kim.
Hi there, Tom, and hi, Dr. Kim.
Hi.
Here's my situation. I'm in dire need of some dental work, and I'm disabled. I'm on Social Security and Medicare, and Medicare doesn't cover, you know, ordinary dental work. And my problem is I can't find a dentist who will work with me in terms of making payments over, like, 18 months or something. The closest I ever came was one dentist had a there was some organization or a credit card type company that would finance the thing without interest, but the monthly payment, even the minimum one, was out of my price range. And so here I am, and I'm in California. Do you have any idea where to find a dentist? And someone said to go to find a place with a dental school, but as far as I know, there's none near here. So I'm kind of, it's just kind of gotten to be fairly dire. So
San Diego is a pretty good size.
You can recommend.
I was actually going to say the same thing. I think the best option for you will be dental school. I think they're. San Diego is a pretty big place where I know they do have some dental school around the area. Or go to those free clinics. I think they open up once in a while a free dental clinic where you can get the not the majority of the work, but at least the minimum work that's required.
Do you know how you find the free clinics?
I think if you go to dental school websites, they usually
ones. Oh, the dental schools run the free clinics.
Some of them do, or they have it like once a year as a event.
Right, or super discounted.
Yeah, or they might do it for free. I know some. When I went to University of Maryland, we had some of those free events.
And it's where the students are practicing,
mm-hmm,
basically.
Exactly.
So you're getting a student dentist, but it'll be far enough along in their training that they're sufficiently competent.
Of course, and obviously there's a practicing dentist that actually has a license overseeing it. So
right.
The work should be good.
Good luck, Scott. I wish you the best on that. Thanks for the call. Jeff in Aberdeen, South Dakota, you have a question for Dr. June Kim?
Hi, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thanks, Jeff.
I was just wondering what the effects are of sodium fluoride in your toothpaste and water and, you know, anything else that it could be in.
Fluoride is kind of a hot topic in some circles. Thank you, Jeff, for the question.
I see. Fluoride strengthens your teeth. What it does is it's a big mineral. You kind of think of it as a big rock. And what it does is whenever you brush your tooth, you're actually abrading your tooth a tiny bit. So you're making some scratches in your teeth, and when that happens, your tooth, not only your toothbrush, but whenever you eat anything acidic or basic, your body's constantly trying to remineralize and pretty much melt your tooth a tiny bit.
Right.
And when that happens, when you have fluoride in there, it actually becomes part of the tooth and actually makes the tooth stronger.
Fluoride bonds as if it's calcium, in other words.
Yes.
Isn't one of the concerns about fluoride that it does that systemically and it can cause more brittleness of our bones if we have large quantities of fluoride?
I think so, but the problem is that large quantity is quite large.
Generally not a meal.
Yeah.
So fluoridation of water supplies, you're not...
I'm not too worried about that. Actually, that's fluoride, I believe, helped.
It's okay. You're just talking to me right now.
So fluoride actually helped reduce a lot of cavities.
Yeah.
Because
it hardens them.
Yes.
Makes them more resistant to bacteria.
And also reduces sensitivity too. So when you as you age, your tooth, your dentin, which is that yellow part of the tooth, gets more and more exposed.
Fluoride will mineralize that.
Yeah, that part of the floor, which is your root surface.
Hang on, we'll be right back. 15 minutes past the hour. Dr. June Kim with us.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, taking your questions for the dentist here on the Tom Hartman Program, 15 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Did you want to finish that thought?
Yeah. So, fluoride actually helps remineralize your tooth mostly, but when you're younger, you get a lot of what's called occlusal caries, which is in between your fissures and pits, in between your top of your tooth. But as you get older, you actually have a lot of root caries, which is where the root is showing on your gum.
Right.
And
caries being the fancy dental word for cavities.
Cavities, yeah. In a sense. And when you get those, fluoride actually helps you remineralize those areas and reduces some sensitivity that a lot of older generations are starting to get more and more.
So if you have an issue with sensitivity with your teeth, there's also the anti-sensitivity toothpaste that contains nitrites.
Sensodyne.
Nitrate.
Nitrate.
Nitric acid. Is that
nitric
acid. Something like that.
Yeah.
But it fills the holes in the tooth, doesn't it?
It acts similar to, not really similar to fluoride, but it does reduce your, reduces that sensitivity.
Right, over the short term.
Mm-hmm, I'll try using fluoride toothpaste first.
Cool. Okay. Betty, in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, watching on Free Speech TV, you are on the air with Dr. Jun Kim.
Thank you for answering. Doctor, I'd like to know what you think of metal implants for teeth, especially in the elderly.
So when you talk about metal, you're probably talking about titanium because the majority of implants are made out of titanium. And so a lot of older generations, older people have a lot of tooth problems, so they're missing a lot of tooth. And the best, right now, the standard is becoming implants. And when people have dentures, I highly recommend you get at least 3 or 4 implants on the bottom and few on the top. But mostly the problem is the bottom one because a lot of people don't have strong bone on the bottom teeth. So their denture really don't fit, and a lot of people end up making dentures and then they throw it away, and then they make another pair about 2-3 years down the road, and then they throw it away again. The best, because the main reason is because people don't like how it fits, and they complain that they can't chew with it. When they first make it, they love it because it's fitting really well. But over time, you're going to lose a lot of bone too, so it starts to wiggle down the road. So I recommend as soon as you lose a tooth, the best time is to get an implant. At least put the titanium in your bone.
Now, implant is where they take a little peg of titanium and drive it down into the bone, seat it in the bone, and then attach a tooth to the top of it.
Yes.
Right?
It takes certain times. I would recommend you at least wait about a year for the titanium to osteointegrate, which means it binds to the bone.
And really?
It takes some time for that to happen.
Right.
Nowadays, more and more people are doing quick implants where they try to get it in as soon as possible so that people could chew on it.
Right.
But just like any other part of your body, it takes time for your bone to heal.
So should you put the metal implant in and not the tooth on top of it for a year? And then wait a year to put the tooth on top of it on?
Yeah, I would recommend at least 6 to 8 months before you get it. Yeah, so it's
not a quick
fix. Of
course, if it's a front
tooth,
that's a somewhat different issue.
Then you could put a crown on top of it, but the problem is you don't want any movement during integration.
During that period of time when the implant itself is bonding to the bone.
Yeah.
Fascinating. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Dr. Jun Kim here in our studios answering your questions about dentistry. We're going to take a short one-hour break, another 40 minutes from politics here, and talk about our bodies, right? And specifically our mouths. Dr. Jun Kim is with us, a dentist, practices here in Washington, D.C., and kind enough to come on the program. Very, very knowledgeable, thoughtful guy. And Dan in St. Paul, Minnesota, you are on the air with Dr. Kim.
Thanks for taking my call. My question for Dr. Kim was, what is his opinion of mercury in fillings?
Dr. Kim?
I think we touched this a little bit last time, too. The mercury, which we're talking about, I believe, amalgam, the silver fillings, when it's placed, it doesn't have too much effect in it on you. But when you place it and when you remove it, that's when the mercury actually comes out of those silver fillings. The amalgam, which is that silver filling in composite, which is the plastic materials, are very different material to start off. The amalgam, which is that silver filling, are actually placed into your tooth, and over time they expand. So it kind of wedges into your tooth. The problem nowadays that I find, and a lot of dentists find, is those old silver fillings, over time, because you're chewing on them so much, they act like a wedge on your tooth, and they actually split your tooth.
Hmm.
So they cause a lot of cracking of your tooth, you end up breaking a lot of your tooth, and majority of them end up needing a replacement, or you're going to end up needing a crown or root canal, and sometimes you even have to extract the tooth because we can't really save that tooth anymore. Right. I would recommend, if it's a small filling, if it's a small mercury filling, I would recommend just keeping it as it is. But over time, you're going to end up replacing them anyways.
So, and that's interesting because I had assumed that the new white
composite
fillings, that they were an attempt to avoid the mercury. And I remember back when they first came on the market, you know, my dentist was saying, well, this isn't as good as the mercury, but I can sell it to you. It turns out they're actually better than mercury fillings?
Yeah, as technology increases, you know, everything's getting better and better. And now those plastic material, what they do is they actually bond onto the tooth. So they actually keep the tooth together.
Right.
It's just kind of like a glue. They bond onto the tooth.
Rather than splitting the tooth apart like the mercury does. What about gold?
Gold is actually the best material out there. I mean, if you can get a crown on it. The problem with gold nowadays is the aesthetic. I mean, a lot of people don't, even older generations, don't want to see those gold-looking tooths on your mouth. Because every time you talk, it shines on you.
Right.
But it is the best material out there. It's very malleable, which means that it molds very well. The good thing about that is it molds onto your tooth really well so that you have less chance of getting a cavity because they actually gets really molded onto your tooth.
And it's totally non-reactive, so it's not like the mercury hitting your nervous system or, you know, something else.
And I heard that it actually keeps the same taste, too, whether it's true or not. I'm not too sure.
Well, yeah, it's so non-reactive, so it probably wouldn't interact with your taste buds. Yeah, perfect sense. Carol in Langley, Washington. You're on the air with Dr. June Kim.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. I love my dentist. I got to tell you that. He's a great guy. But I had recently, I had a tooth pulled last year, one of the back teeth on the bottom, very back tooth on the bottom. Now, it's upstairs neighbor. He suggested a crown for that tooth. And I thought, why should I pay for a crown when we might as well just pull it because there's no downstairs neighbor to chew against? Are you with me so far, Dr. Kim?
Yes. So you don't have any tooth on the top opposing that tooth? Correct?
Well, I didn't have any tooth on the bottom opposing the top tooth. And so rather than go along with what my dentist said was to have a crown or to have a crown, I thought, why should I do that? It's the difference. There's an $800 difference in the cost, and I thought being that there wasn't anything to chew on the on the bottom, it didn't have a downstairs neighbor. I thought, well, I'll just have him pull the tooth.
Right.
And when I asked, I asked him, I go, well, what are my pros and cons? How can I make a decision about this? I get a call back saying from his office saying, just my choice. Why wouldn't he give me a pros and cons about that? I don't get it. I ended up having it pulled, and I'm not sure that I made the right decision.
I think as a dentist, you want to save as many teeth as you can. Because over the long term, I mean, I'm not really sure if you have, when you talk about back teeth, there's two molars. There's first molar and second molar. And when you talk about the last teeth, if it's the second molar, research says that you really just need up to the first molar for you to chew really well. And you really can't make too much distinguishing.
That's the forward molar.
Forward molar. The first big tooth that you see on the front. Yes, you're correct in the sense that if you don't have an opposing one on the top, then why should we keep it? But the idea is to make sure that you get something on the bottom, too, so that you actually have a better chance of chewing. Yes, if you pull the top tooth and you don't have anything on the bottom now, then it wouldn't affect too much, would you? But once you start losing more of your front tooth, which is your first molar, then once you lose the first molar, then you really can't chew very well at all. When you later down the road, when you decide to get an implant or a denture or anything on that missing space, if you don't have anything opposing to it, now you actually have to get something for the top again.
So you're saying that the better solution, although it would cost more, would have been to put a crown on that top tooth and then put something at that bottom tooth.
My opinion, my opinion is to get the bottom one figured out first, if you're going to get one on something on the bottom or not.
Yeah.
And then make a decision what you want to do with the top one. Obviously, if you never decide to get anything for the bottom one, then there's really no point of keeping that one on the top, because over time it's...
So Carol's had a pull now. Her, so now her choices are...
Either, I mean, if it was the first molar, then you're gonna know that you can't really chew too well on that side. But if it's not...
Carol, thank you for the call. We'll be back with more of your questions for Dr. Jun Kim, a dentist practicing in Washington, D.C., kind enough to come on the air and talk with us. He's got nothing to sell, no website to hype. It's kind of refreshing having somebody who's just sharing his experience with us. We'll be back. I see the board is pretty full, so we've got a lot of questions here about dentistry. Stick with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We're taking a slight break from politics here a little while. We'll be back with your questions on dentistry. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Dr. Jun Kim is in our studio just hanging out and sharing his dental expertise with us all. And thank you very much for that.
No problem.
It's great having you here with us, Jun. And Mike in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, you have an interesting question. Go for it.
Yes, sir. I am 58 years old. I've been to the dentist 3 times. First time, get the x-rays. Second time, got my wisdom teeth pulled. Third time was for a cleaning, and that was in my 20s. I have never had a cavity, never had a problem with my teeth. My 2 sons, who have horrible health insurance and do not have the money to go to the dentist, they've never had a cavity, never had a problem other than wisdom tooth, in which we paid for. And I just wonder if maybe, give me the circumstance, I could pass my DNA to the masses.
So, yeah, it's a good question, Mike. Thank you for that. Why is it that Mike and his kids have never had a cavity?
Well, you must have really good genes. You're really lucky, but not many people have that gene, unfortunately.
Does this, you know, I remember when this was like 20 years ago. There was they had identified Streptococcus mutans, I think, as the principal bacteria that eats teeth, and there was all this talk about creating a vaccine for it.
Mm-hmm.
Could it be that Mike's immune system is putting out something that kills off Streptococcus mutans? Or is it that the pH or the environment of his mouth, for some reason that has to do with his genetics, is hostile to that particular bacteria? Or what's going on with this? And is that bacteria contagious? Could it be that, you know, people don't have it through part of their life and then they start kissing people and they get it from somebody else or something like that?
Yeah, it is very you can get it from kissing, and that's how kids get it from their moms. Stemripen, nowadays they're starting to make these, not a vaccine, but they do have strep mutant that doesn't cause cavity. So you can't just remove strep mutant from your mouth. The problem is your mouth has a whole bunch of bacteria. There's good ones and there's bad ones. And strep mutant is one of the bad ones. Nowadays, they realize that if they're trying to not just remove it, but make one that actually acts the same way but doesn't cause cavities.
So it still has the place in the flora fauna thing.
Yeah, because it's a biofilm. You don't really want to remove it because you don't know what's going to happen next.
Right.
So you want to keep the biofilm the way it is. You want to have some good bacteria and some bad bacteria, but you want to make the bad bacteria so that it doesn't cause cavities.
So they're, what, genetically engineering strep mutants?
I think they're trying to do
inoculating people with them?
Yeah, I think they're trying to find a way to do that.
Fascinating.
Yeah, but I get that
all
the time.
Put dentists out of business, though. You know, is that going to happen?
I'm sure there's a lot of other problems. Then tooth are cracking for different reasons.
Yeah,
as age. They think cavity is the majority of the problem, but majority of the problem actually isn't cavity alone. It's actually all the other habit that people have. Grinding issues are becoming more and more a problem because people are getting more stressed out. For some reason.
As the economy continues to fall. It's 34 years of Reaganomics. Hey, we got back to politics. Thank you, Jim. Okay. Kevin, in Dallas, Oregon, or the Dalles, Oregon, you have a question for Dr. Kim?
Yeah, it's Dallas, Oregon.
Oh, Dallas. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. I was wondering, I'm looking at the back of my toothpaste here, and it says that you're not supposed to swallow it, and if you do swallow it, you're supposed to contact the poison control center. Now, what is it that's in the toothpaste that is poison?
I wouldn't say it's poison, but it's mostly for they have that almost in anything, but it's mostly for kids. Kids, they can't take too much fluoride. It causes other problems. So for adults, it really doesn't cause too much problem. But it's
so this
more
is for,
for
if a kid eats the whole tube of toothpaste, you need to literally get them to throw up. Go call a poison control center.
I wouldn't, but they would definitely get, even for adults, they'll get sick if you swallow the whole tube.
So it's an excessive caution, Kevin.
Mm-hmm. But
Kevin,
make sure you don't have that polyethylene in your toothpaste.
Yeah.
Or if you do, make sure you throw it away and get something that doesn't have it.
Yeah. Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. Melissa, in Monticello, Florida, you're on the air with Dr. June Kim.
Hello, doctor. This is Melissa, and you just mentioned grinding. And I was diagnosed at 30 years old. I'm in my 50s now. And when I was 30 years old, my dentist said that I had the grinding of an 80-year-old. And now I've been diagnosed what is called enveloping. And why am I doing this, and what causes, I mean, you said stress, but why am I doing such grinding my whole life?
Grinding comes from several reasons, and stress is one of the reasons. People really can't pinpoint what's causing it. Your muscles are reacting to either emotional problems or just some people have more grinding issue than others.
Yeah. My dad did that his whole life, and so do I. And I think it's the little bit of OCD that's in both of us. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Melissa, thank you for the call. Is there any attempt to treat people who are grinding with things like anti-anxiety drugs or things?
There's muscle relaxants. You can take muscle relaxants, but that's for a temporary relief, unfortunately.
Yeah. And if those are benzo drugs, then you've got a problem with habituation.
Yeah, and the less drug you take, the better it is.
Yeah.
So NightGuard's, unfortunately, the only way right now we're trying to solve the issue, NightGuard's.
Yeah, those things that you put in.
Yeah.
So now you're chewing on a piece of rubber.
Plastic, pretty much.
So and now you're swallowing little bits of plastic all night? Is that a good thing?
Of course not, but hopefully you don't grind and then you don't eat the whole thing off it, but you do they do wear off, and you want to make sure that you get a new piece when you
chewed it up and swallowed it.
Exactly.
Eric in Tacoma, Washington. Eric, you have a question for Dr. Kim?
Yeah, it's kind of the same grinding issue, except I'm still in my 20s, and I've had a kind of grinding issue. The grinding issue is completely gone now. However, the tops of my enamel, and I have perfect teeth, never had a cavity, nothing, absolutely white teeth.
Wow.
But the tops of my enamels has eroded away, and so I have slight difficulty in chewing. So I was wondering if I have to contact a dentist who specializes in onlays or inlays or overlays instead of getting full crowns, because I have really good natural teeth that are just the base and the function of the teeth is completely properly functional.
Doesn't this tie into the genetic thing of some people have soft teeth which tend to be white and other people have hard teeth which tend to yellow, but they're harder and they last longer, and it's a genetic thing, or do I have that wrong?
If the tooth is more yellow, that means you have less layer of enamel. So the whiter your tooth is, I mean, the problem with some of the whiteness is also if some people have fluoride issue, fluorosis, so which makes you have these white spots in your tooth. Those tooth are weaker. But naturally, if you have more of a yellowish tooth, that means that your enamel, which is the hard part of on the top, which makes it white, that means that you have less of that.
So to Eric's question.
You could go to a dentist and check to see if you could have inlay and onlay on these teeth. But usually the problem is when you grind down, that you grind down majority of your teeth, not just one of it. So you might actually need a comprehensive treatment where you actually need to get some inlays and onlays on all your tooth to fix that problem. I would go with the more conservative route of keeping the tooth as you have it right now, especially if you're in your 20s, I believe you were saying, so that you preserve it for the later down the road.
Yeah, okay. Eric, thank you for the call. We are not, by the way, we need to phrase these answers in the third person. You know, a person with this kind of situation might want to.
Yeah.
Because we can't offer medical advice here.
Of course.
Belinda in driving through New York. Hey, Belinda.
My name is Belinda, and I'm from Blowing Rock, North Carolina. We're traveling.
Uh-huh.
And I'm very fortunate to have heard this show because I've just started oil pulling.
Well, oil pulling?
And I'm wondering what you... Yes, it's an old practice where you take a teaspoon to tablespoon of a good refined... I use organic coconut oil, which has an antibacterial... microbial effect, and you swish it in your mouth first thing in the morning, and for about 15 minutes, and I do that every day. I'm 63 years old, and I'd started experiencing occasional, like, bleeding of the gum, you know, and the tooth is getting long in the tooth, so to speak, and this has improved my gums, and I've been doing it for 2 months.
Huh. Have you ever heard of this? You heat the oil up?
No, you spit it out. And in fact, it becomes, they suggest you even throw it in the trash, you know, spit it in the trash.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you just take an ounce of oil and swish it around in your mouth for 15 minutes every morning. You ever heard of this, Dr.?
Yes. This is more and more becoming a trend in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not too sure how much really effect it has. Yes, about that antibacterial stuff. It can have that effect in it, but I'm not really sure how much it actually really improves.
Nobody knows how it works?
I haven't heard anything much about it.
Fascinating. Belinda, thank you for sharing that with us. Sometimes, you know, folklore gets ahead of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it may be that there's some incredible characteristics to it.
Sure.
On the other hand, it might just be the way it's dead. Okay. We'll be back with more of your questions for Dr. Jun Kim right after.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your questions for Dr. Jun Kim right after this. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Andy in San Mateo, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You're on the air with Dr. Kim.
Hello. Thanks for your show, Tom. And Dr. Kim, thank you for your time today. I recently, for the last 4 years, have had three throat cancers, and at each one of them I went through the chemo and radiation, and each time it was 30 radiations. And I've had a total of 96 total radiations to my face, and my bottom teeth are really starting to have issues now. They said that could possibly happen. My top teeth are fine, though, and I went in to try to get some implants for the bottom side because my top side is still good, and I felt like they didn't want anything to do with me. They just wanted to get me out the door, and it was really disheartening to feel that, you know, that I wasn't being cared for, or that they really didn't even give me an alternative, even dentures. And I'm kind of lost as far as which direction to head into. Is there any new type of implants that could help me, and what is the issue with my radiation to my bottom jaw that makes them not want to deal with me?
Radiation damages tissue so it doesn't rebuild itself, does it?
It damages your bone, too. So your bone has a hard time of healing back, unfortunately.
Right.
In your case, I would shy away from getting implants.
Well, let's not talk about Andy's case. Medical advice. Mm-hmm. But for somebody with that kind of a situation.
Well, a lot of people who have all these cancer problems, especially to the throat or anybody who has gone through cancer problems, I would shy away from getting implants because your body can't heal very well. And implants is all about healing. You got to make sure that it could heal. The bone could osteointegrate, like I said before. Your bone needs to pretty much glue onto that implant. And if that doesn't happen, then that implant's going to come out and you're going to get infection in there again. So in cases like that where you have, when you have cancer, the best choice is go a little bit less aggressive where you want to get a denture first and see if that fits well and go through that route. And when you actually heal better, then go ahead and do your implants.
Right. Yeah. Down the road. I have a friend who had throat cancer and he was quite overweight and he lost a lot of weight and he went to his doctor and said, can I have some surgery to get rid of all this extra skin? And they said, no, you can't, because your skin, you can't stitch your skin back mm-hmm. after surgery if it's been irradiated as heavily as yours has, because mm-hmm. it just doesn't grow. It's mostly mm-hmm. basically scar tissue.
Yes.
Is that the kind of thing that
you're talking
about?
Yeah, it's the same issue that your bone and skin just does not heal very well anymore. Because radiation in itself is pretty much blindly killing all the, well, not blinding, but you are killing the cells and right. pretty much inhibiting them from growing.
So it's killing the cancer, but it's also killing a lot of the cells around it.
Yes, a lot of the good cells around it too.
Yeah. So just a denture, that would be just a physical thing that floats in your mouth. You could put it in and take it.
I think the best route for cases where you had so much radiation, especially if you've done it more than one or twice before, then you want to go to a route where you get a denture first so that right. it doesn't cause too much damage to your bones or anything right. else.
And stabilize them.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll be back with more of your questions for Dr. June Kim right after. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Dr. June Kim has dropped by to talk dentistry, and then we're going to brush our teeth and go to lunch. Okay. Cora in Taos, New Mexico, listening on KVOT. Hey, Cora, you're on the air with Dr. Kim.
Yes, I really appreciate you, Dr. Kim.
Thank you.
I recently had to go to the dentist. I'm almost 59, but I'm going to be undergoing chemo for ovarian cancer. And what had happened was, over the past few years, I literally had four teeth crumble. And so my chemo doctors suggested going to the dentist to see if they needed to be pulled because of a possible infection, you know. And my dentist told me I have no cavities because probably when I was growing up, I drank well water. And she says that would also cause my teeth to just crumble. And I wondered if you had heard this before.
Well water, the problem with that is not having enough fluoride in it. So when the tooth is developing, you want to have some fluoride in it so that it actually strengthens it while it's being made.
So in some parts of the country, there's naturally occurring fluoride in the well water, and in
yes.
other places there is.
Even this country before, we didn't have fluoride before.
Yeah.
And nowadays, I think we're trying to revert back into, for some reason, that a lot of people are trying to stay away from fluoride in their water. I would suggest keeping that fluoride in the water because it's been helping a lot more people. Research shows that it's been helping a lot more people.
Right.
Than
and for somebody who's, and I know that when Louise had breast cancer, she went through chemo, and this was the first, one of the things he said is get anything done that you're going to get done that's going to require healing, you know, dental work, anything else, get that done before the chemo. Because once the chemo starts, it's sort of like the radiation. It's going to really, really whack your ability to rebound from this.
Yeah. People who have cancer, the first thing they think about is cancer. Unfortunately, they don't really think too much about their teeth. You want to go to a dentist before you even start any radiation. So the dentist could actually do a little bit more aggressive treatment in a sense. If the tooth is, you know, needs a lot more work, it's sometimes better to take that tooth out in people who's going to need
right.
chemotherapy.
There is a careful timing thing, though, because if you're still healing and you're still bleeding and then you start chemo, or radiation. That's a problem, too, because you won't be healing. You have to wait until it's healed.
Yes, but also people also have problem in between chemo where they start to have tooth problems. And then you're stuck in that dilemma. What do I do? Do we keep on going to chemo first?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So. Cora, I wish you the very best. Thanks for the call. I'm sorry to hear your challenge. Norman in Palm Bay, Florida. You're on the air with Dr. Kim.
How you doing?
Good.
Good deal. Hey, wanted to ask about dental implants. Are they at a stage right now where they're permanent for life? You can put them in with no infections or anything like that because I have good teeth and bones and all that. Well, I need a couple teeth, but I have good bones.
Unfortunately, nothing's for life, but implants are, the technology is up to the point where once you place it, you could keep it forever in a sense. But obviously, just like anything else, you got to make sure you take care of it. Once you put it in, make sure you brush well around it too, because there you can get problems. You can, implants can get infected again too. You won't get cavities on implants because they're titanium bars, but you could have periodontal problems and abscess underneath it too.
Hmm.
Which
and that's typically from not having the implant bond to the bone before you put the crown on it?
Yeah, a lot of times implants, when it's osteointegrating, which is means that it's binding to the bone, you can't have any movement on it. You don't want any movement on that implant. Mm-hmm. Anytime you have a slight movement on that thing, your body's going to have a hard time gluing onto it. And you're going to get a lot. Majority of the infection is happening when you place it, after you place it within a few months.
Right.
But over long term, you can get implants infected again, too.
Yeah. Interesting. Tressa in Flatwoods, Kentucky. You're on the air with Dr. June Kim.
Greetings from a Kentucky liberal.
Well, thank you.
I have a question for Dr. Kim. Recently, my family dentist retired. He's old school, and he and his hygienist solely did hand scaling. I'm shopping around for a new dentist, and I'm learning about this new thing called ultrasonic cleaning. And I was just wondering about Dr. Kim's input on that. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, a lot of people, a lot of hygienists use that. And
first, let's define what this is. Hand scaling is what?
Hand scaling is literally using an instrument, a scaler, which is the sharp instrument that hygienists use to scrape underneath your gum, between your, pretty much on your root, to remove any calculus or plaque on your tooth.
Right.
Cavitron or ultrasonic, these instruments are pretty much these sharp tools that vibrate over 1,000 times seconds. What it does is it disturbs the biofilm and remove any calculus. It's kind of like a washing machine in a sense. It goes in there and sprays water and vibrates around it. But it can't be replaced for hand scale. So a lot of times they use that to remove the bulk of calculus plaque, and then they go back in with hand scale to remove the rest of it.
So this is just a new tool for...
It's been around for a long time, actually.
Okay. We just have 45 seconds, so I don't have time to put somebody on the air, but some of the questions that I can see, do you know anything about biomimetic?
Biomimetic dentistry.
What is that?
Actually, I practice that too. It's a new trend where, well, it's not a new trend, but it's mostly in California a lot of people are doing this where you're sinking a tooth, instead of putting a crown on it, you're putting a filling and you're making it look very natural. And it's all about making sure that the tooth look exactly what it was before any drilling was done, before your tooth, any damage was done to the tooth. But there's a specific way that you have to put in a filling to make sure that the filling could last for a long time.
Huh. Biomimetic, as in imitating biology.
Yes,
imitating
that's what the word comes from.
Great. Dr. June Kim, thank you so much for being with us.
No problem.
And thank you for being with us all day today. We will be back tomorrow, back to politics. And I guess in summary, I should say dentistry begins with you. Go see your dentist, tag your it. But no, actually, also politics begins with you. Democracy begins with you. So get out there, get active, tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartmann here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartmann program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.